Yes, indeed. Well, anyway, we're all glad that we're back together for another week. And it'll be a very interesting week, a very active week. And so I've made every effort to get caught up in the grading and stuff. So I've got everything out to grade, and I've got the key terms graded. I just don't have it recorded yet. And it's all good. So we're making progress. I am at least getting this class where it needs to be and other class where it needs to be. So you'll be able to start believing your scores here on Moodle very shortly. At any rate, so like I said, for those who just arrived, the grades are done. Tests are done. Tests are being put in your boxes this moment. The grades on Moodle are there. What's on your paper is 136 points, but what I put on Moodle was 125. So there's quite a few good scores, and then there's some dodgy scores, but it's the nature of the beast sometimes. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, please help us get through this week. We have a lot of responsibilities that we need to do, and it seemingly they're overwhelming at times. Keep us focused, keep us healthy and safe. Please allow us to choose wisely so that we always make time for spiritual growth and physical growth, social growth. And may we find success today and tomorrow and the next day and the following days, so at the end of this week, when we look back on it, we can say, thank you, Lord, for helping us make this week all that it can be. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, we're finishing up. We're in the middle of metabolism. We are near the end of chapter 15, and we're looking at the pentose phosphate pathway. Pentose phosphate pathway. And we can see here that it is enormously complicated. You memorized it. If you were going to speculate what enzyme was most highly controlled in this mechanism, in this pathway, what enzyme would you probably choose? If you had to choose which enzyme to be most highly controlled, which one would you choose? Again, this is a higher order critical thinking skill question. Anybody like to hazard, this is the old non-electronic clicker question. So you can see the numbers there, here. So do I hear a vote? Let's just go for extremes. Do I hear a vote? Let's see a vote for number one enzyme as the most likely to be highly controlled. All right, I see two. How about number three as most likely to be highly controlled? Any there? There's one, two. What about, let's go to the other extreme. How about eight? Anybody vote for eight? Eight. Okay. How about seven? Transaldolase. Anybody for seven? Okay. All right. So we had a total of four people vote. Four people were courageous. Good for them. All right. Considering there was nothing on the line on this, I don't see what courage it took to, or fear it took not to vote. But at any rate, as you might suspect, and the four that voted were correct in terms of the logic of it, it would either be three or one. And considering that 6-phosphoglucolactone, gamma-lactone, delta-lactone, pardon me, or 6-phosphogluconate, neither one of those are molecules that are used in other pathways. Since they're not used in other pathways, then it's enzyme number one that is, in fact, going to be the most highly controlled. If you recall, the logic would be, do you remember in the glycolytic pathway, glycolysis, what enzyme is the most highly controlled and most intricately controlled? What? Well, it is. Hexokinase is controlled. Yes, it is, absolutely. And when you look at the nature of the control, which ones did we list that were controlled? In fact, hexokinase, PFK1, and there was one more that was highly controlled in that little table, especially in muscle. Remember what that was? Preacher's kid. Pyruvate kinase, yes. Yes, the confidence level needs to rise a little bit more when I say PK and enzyme PK and glycolysis. Bingo, it ought to show up as pyruvate kinase. Yeah, one of the reasons why this PFK1 is the most highly controlled and it has the most important control, primarily because one of the earlier enzymes in that compounds is glucose-6-phosphate. And glucose-6-phosphate, as you know, has a variety of fates in it. So the truly first committed and highly controlled step is PFK1 because it's after glucose-6-phosphate. So that is the one of the generalities that you can apply to all pathways is that if there are multiple points of control, many times the most elaborate control, the most effective control, occurs after a substrate that has multiple uses, so that the rest of the pathway then is controlled by that enzyme following the multi-use substrate. Okay, so it's actually number one, although number three would make a logical guess. Why would 7 and 8 make no sense? Yes?
I have a
question.
Right. So, if the second two molecules don't have any use in the cell...
No, I didn't say... Well, not use in the cell. I said had no other use in the cell. Right.
Why does it matter that you control it before that?
Well, if you control it here, number 3... It's an excellent question. If you control it here... Then if this stops and number one doesn't stop, you're going to build up these two compounds here that may or may not have deleterious effects in the cell. In other words, that if you control it here and stop it, but these have no other use and these begin to build up, they can alter, for example, the osmotic pressure in the cell, something like that. Yes. It has to do with the analogy. Let's see, how can I say this? You know, I just made haystacks. The analogy is this: I just made a bunch of haystacks on a Saturday night for. All those gymnasts. I was the person who picked up the plate and put the chips on the plate, and I was the person that controlled the flow through the rest of the line. Now, if, however, the sauce, the last thing you put on, was the controlling thing, okay. Whether or not there was a person there, I would just continue to put chips on a plate, whether there was somebody to pick it up or not, okay, because the control was after me, and my chemical reaction is to put chips on a plate, and I'm just going to make it there no matter what. All right, so in other words, that having control early prevents any kind of excess of these materials from being formed. Yeah. Right. It has to do with, are there other materials that are part of it? Let's see. Do we have glycolysis on this one? Is glycolysis in here? Yeah, there it is. As you can see here, if you notice on this particular overhead, we have three enzymes that are controlled in glycolysis. Hexokinase, it has a single inhibitor. This is a feedback inhibitor. PFK1, which has multiple levels of inhibitors and activators, and PK, for muscle at least, is simply ATP. When you go back and you look at the structures here, PFK1 is right here. Notice, however, one substrate earlier is glucose-6-phosphate. And if you recall, glucose-6-phosphate has multiple levels of purpose. If glucose-6-phosphate builds up, that's fine because it can go over to pentose phosphate or it can go back to can be made into glycogen synthesis. Yeah. So, yeah, there is a remarkable logic to all this that would be almost impossible to be by accident. I mean, when I say almost impossible, I'm talking like 10 to the minus 34th. My phone is ringing, and please, I apologize for not turning it off, and I'm just going to ignore it. So, this is the top form, of course, is what? How would you describe that? That's the oxidizing step, because you oxidize carbohydrate and you then reduce NADP to make NADPH. You get three molecules there and three molecules there. You get three carbon dioxides here and three of these, five units, and then they go through here and get rearranged. And so eventually at the end of it, you've taken 18 carbons to be made into 15 carbons and three carbon dioxides and six NADPHs, which are very, very important for what? What do you use NADPH for? What do you use NADPH for? What would be the general term that you would use for it? Biosynthesis. Thank you very much. Please don't forget it. Biosynthesis. Now, interestingly enough, there are genetic diseases linked to this particular pathway. So here we have first blank on overhead number 20 is G6PD, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, which is this particular enzyme right there. That's this one. It's abbreviated as 6-GPD. It's regulating for the oxidative portion, which is basically the entire thing. You got substrate availability is the next blank. The next blank is glutathione peroxidase. The next blank is actually genetic. Genetic, sorry. Then glutathione peroxidase, then GSSG, then you got NADPH, you got reductase is the next blank, peroxides, stress is the last, next to the last blank, and freely reversible. So you've got G6PD, substrate, genetic, glutathione peroxidase, GSSG, NADPH, reductase, peroxides, reversible. Okay, so that dehydrogenase is the rate-controlling enzyme in this particular step. It's primarily regulated by substrate availability, oddly enough. This means that as NADP plus concentrations in the cell increase, the rate of that enzyme increases. So it's primarily controlled by biosynthetic demand is how you would interpret that. If NADPH is if NADPH is used for biosynthesis and that particular enzyme is controlled by NADP plus concentrations, the more NAD plus there is, that means there's greater demands for biosynthesis. At any rate, sorry. Now then, so genetic deficiency is one of the most common genetic diseases. This is worldwide. It's not just the United States. So you have a little bit of a deficiency of that enzyme. What immediately does that imply about the probable concentration of NADPH in the cell? Is it going to be relatively high or relatively low if there's a genetic deficiency of G6PD? Relatively high levels of NADPH or relatively low levels of NADPH? How many vote high levels of NADPH? All right. How many people vote low levels of NADPH? Yeah, actually, with this being deficient, this being deficient, there's going to be a relative lack of this NADPH being made. Exactly right. Okay, so thank you for all those who voted. Good. Glutathione, GSH, glutathione. Let's say the name, glutathione. Glutathione is one of these important small molecules that are seldom thought of but are very, very important. They don't have the same kind of sophistication and some other genetic type gene reactions might have, but glutathione is a very important molecule in the cell. It has a fairly simple hydrocarbon structure, and then it's got the SH there indicates that it's got a sulfhydryl group on there. A reduced sulfur, essentially, is available. And what this is used for is to, primarily, among other things, it's not just in the red blood cell, but it can occur in others, but we're going to look at the red blood cell. It's reduced peroxides in red blood cells and other cells. The red blood cell, of course, is constantly exposed to elemental oxygen in the lungs. And there are lots of amino acids and so on that can combine this oxygen in strange forms and make lots of peroxides, which are, you know, free radical oxygens, and they do a lot of damage to red blood cell membranes, even any membranes. Peroxides have a tendency to oxidize fatty acids, and that makes them less usable as membrane components. So glutathione is the reducing agent being acted upon by glutathione peroxidase. It takes these peroxides and glutathione under the influence of glutathione peroxidase and makes the oxidized form of glutathione and then an alcohol form of the peroxide in water. That alcohol form is then recycled through processes in the liver. And so then the GSSG, which is reduced, which is oxidized, has to be recycled by NADPH. So the oxidized form of glutathione called GSSG is reduced by NADPH under the influence of glutathione reductase to make the reduced form of the glutathione and the NAD+, which is then recycled through the pentose phosphate pathway. Again, excess peroxides, which can occur easily, will destroy red blood cells. Knockout mice with no G6PD are extremely sensitive to oxidative stress. Slight elevations of oxygen or other kinds of oxidizing agents will cause tremendous damage to these kinds of cells, kinds of mice that have a lack of that G6PD. I'm surprised that they live at all, honestly, but apparently they do. I can't imagine there's no G6PD. Perhaps in the red blood cell there isn't, but there's got to be G6PD somewhere, or else you can't make anything. The fetus wouldn't be able to regrow. All reactions following RU5P are freely reversible. Okay, these reversible reactions used to make ribosis during the times of low NADPH demand. So you can make the 5 carbon sugar without having to make NADPH. And the products of the pentose phosphate pathway enter the glycolytic pathway. Here you see kind of the overall view of where all these carbon skeletons go. You've got glucose going to glucose-6-phosphate. It gets carbon dioxide and NADPH are given off as you make ribulose-5-phosphate. That gets split. That goes into nucleotides. These can be recombined to form fructose-6-phosphate and GAP. Notice these arrows here are, in fact, double-headed. That's not a mistake. These arrows right here are double-headed. That's not a mistake. This arrow here is a single head. That's not a mistake. Once glucose gets committed through that glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, it's committed entirely down that pathway. There's no reversible reaction for it. There's no reverse of, like, gluconeogenesis. There's nothing to go back. Unless, of course, you want to claim, that if those carbon skeletons land here and then go through here and then come back here, GAP and fructose-6-phosphate can be made through gluconeogenesis back into glucose-6-phosphate. You could claim that if you wanted to. But within the oxidative form of it, there's no reversibility of it. And then down here you have the NADH and NADP, ATP. Please, actively recall and always distinguish between NADH and NADPH. Their uses are completely different. There is no exchangeability except on very limited, highly important enzymes that require reducing power to maintain cell life. Now comes one of the more complicated relationships, and one of the more interesting ones. This is a capstone regulatory cascade. It will include a lot of what we've learned so far about metabolism within the cell. And it deals with the most potent regulator of PFK1. Do you remember what I told you was the most potent regulator of PFK1? No? No, not ATP. Let me rephrase that. Yeah, ATP is the most potent inhibitor. Most potent inhibitor. Which one would be the most potent activator? Which one's the most potent activator? It's one that was, I said, it was discovered in 1976. It was the one that was discovered on my birthday and is named after me. No, it's not. I'm just pulling your chain. Looking back on your notes, there was one of these regulators that was redlined. One of the activators that was redlined, and that was fructose 2,6 bisphosphate. Really, Dr. Novak? Yes. Yes, yes, indeed. We can leave it like that. Is that big enough to see? Do I need to turn on the... I'll just make it full screen. All right, let's take a look at this, ladies and gentlemen. What was the purpose of F26P? What did it do? What does it do to glycolysis? Does it turn it on or does it turn it off? Glycolysis. Let me rephrase that. Does it turn on PFK1 or does it turn off PFK1? You can't tell from here. Well, actually, you can if you look carefully. Ooh, you can't tell from here. What? Yeah, there's a plus sign. So what does that mean? It turns it on. So when high levels of fructose 2,6-phosphate exist, guess what? Is glycolysis turned on or off? On. All right, well, let's back the truck up here. Let's just start from that. Okay, so we have that turned on when there's high levels of what compound? High levels of what? Fructose 2,6-BP. So you got that in your mind? High levels of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate turn on glycolysis. What makes high levels of F26P? Well, let's take a look. Now then, interestingly enough, here is a unique enzyme, or protein, pardon me, that actually has two activities on one enzyme, one protein. There is a single protein with two activities. If you want to, you should probably circle these two round oval boxes. One that says PFK2 activity, the other says fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase activity. Circle it and say a single protein with two different activities. A single protein with two different activities. Not activities, one activity is turned on or that same activity is turned off, but one activity that is on or off, and the other activity then is on, then off. Off, then on. What are the two activities in this single protein? The first activity is PFK2 activity, which means it is responsible for the production of what? Right. It's responsible for the production of 2,6. Then on that same protein, at a different location, there is another activity that's entitled, which, not surprisingly, does what to the fructose 2,6-bisphosphate? It takes it and dephosphorylates it, breaks it down. What is the difference between those two states of that protein? When is the PFK2 activity turned on? When that protein is not phosphated, is that correct? When is the phosphatase activity turned on? When that same protein is phosphated. So, that enzyme is turned on, the kinase is turned on when it's not phosphated, and the phosphatase is turned on when it is phosphated. Okay. Yes? Well, it's a single protein, and I don't know how to, I don't know that there's a name for the protein. There probably is. I'm sure there is a name for it. But this protein has basically a single protein, a single chain that has two activities on it. A kinase and a phosphatase. Okay? And there are two states to that. When is the kinase turned on? It's turned on with whenever this unit does not have a phosphate on it. When is the phosphate turned on? Is in when there's a phosphate that's been added to it. So when you see a phosphate on this particular enzyme that has two named activities on it, it being acting as a phosphatase. When that phosphate's been turned, when that phosphate has been removed, the kinase is active. Is that helpful? Okay. Excellent question. Thank you very much. So now, what puts on that activity? What puts a phosphate on that thing? Do you recognize this compound at all? Do you recognize that? It's called, not surprisingly, what? What's the other name for it? Cyclic, and write this under here if you have that printed out, or type it in. Cyclic AMP, or CAMP, cyclic AMP dash dependent protein kinase. CAMP dependent protein kinase. Two names, one enzyme. We'll call it, for the sake of argument, protein kinase A. Protein kinase A has a total of how many subunits involved with it? Four. Two regulatory and two... I don't know if you can see this. Put a big C right there and a C right there. At least handwrite it in or whatever. Each of these individual units... Two of the units are regulatory units. Two of the units are catalytic units. The catalytic units are active only when they're separated from the regulatory units. When the regulatory units and the catalytic units are combined in a single multimeric protein, the catalytic units are inactive. What causes the regulatory units to separate from the catalytic units and then for those catalytic units to become active? What is that material right there? Cyclic AMP. What makes cyclic AMP? What's the enzyme that makes cyclic AMP? What's its two-letter abbreviation? AC. And that would, of course, stand for adenylate cyclase. What turns on adenylate cyclase, at least from what you've memorized? The G proteins. And guess what turns on the G proteins? Yeah, glucagon. Okay, glucagon will. All righty then. Let's see here. So, let's see if the body makes any sense. High levels of glucagon in your blood, does that indicate high levels of fuel in the blood or low levels of fuel in the blood? Low levels of fuel in the blood. How does the liver, at least in this simplified pathway, respond to that? Let's see. High levels of glucagon exist in the blood. That turns on the glucagon transducer system, which stimulates adenylate cyclase, which then makes high levels of cyclic AMP in the cell. This is the liver cell. High levels of cyclic AMP then interact with protein kinase A in the inactive form, bind to the receptors or the regulatory units, release the active catalytic units. Those active catalytic units then act on the PFK2/fructose-2,6-bisphosphatase protein and moves it from being not phosphorylated to being what? Phosphorylated. Moving from being not phosphated to phosphorylated, what does that do to the level of fructose-2,6-bisphosphate? Does that increase it or decrease it? This is decreased when there are high levels of glucagon present. Fructose-2,6-bisphosphate concentrations are decreased with high levels of glucagon in the bloodstream. And what does that do? Okay. Well, fructose-2,6-bisphosphate, if it's present, does what to glycolysis? Stimulates it. With high levels of glucagon in the blood, is there high levels of fructose-2,6-bisphosphate in the cell? What is it? No. That means, what does that mean about the glycolysis? Is it turned on or turned off? It's turned off. Does that make sense? Does that make metabolic sense? If the blood needs fuel, why would turning off glycolysis in the liver cell help put fuel into the blood? So it uses glycogen. Let's see what happens, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? So, let's think about this. High levels of glucagon in the blood. This pathway turns off glycolysis. So what, Dr. Novak? Let's go back and let's take a look at that apparently trivial model we have for carbohydrate fates. Notice, if you would, ladies and gentlemen, here you have this situation. You have high levels of glucagon outside the liver cell. The body needs energy. The liver is a repository for energy. It's a glucose buffer and a fatty acid buffer and a ketone body's buffer. It has stores of all that, or it can at least manipulate stores to produce that. So what happens is high levels of glucagon turn off glycolysis, which means whatever glucose-6-phosphate's in the cell is going where? What does the body need? What does the blood need? Energy or glucose. So whatever glucose-6-phosphate is not going down glycolysis, it's going backwards to be made into what? Glucose, which gets dumped into where? Right. Now then, where can you get more glucose-6-phosphate in the liver cell? Glycogen. So that same glucagon that's inhibiting glycolysis is stimulating glycogen breakdown to make more glucose-6-phosphate and make glucose to dump into the blood. That's the logic behind it. Okay? That is the logic behind it. All right. Okay. Now, you've memorized this, haven't you? You now need to integrate it into your understanding of biochemistry. How, at the hormone level, hormone levels in the blood directly affect the pathways inside the cell, and you understand the logic as to why high levels of glucagon turn on protein kinase A, which turn off the production of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, which then, because there's low levels of 2,6, inhibits glycolysis, which then prevents carbohydrate going down glycolysis, but allows it to then get stored or remain as glucose 6-phosphate and get changed into glucose and get dumped back into the blood. So there's not this odd feudal cycle where glycogen is being degraded into glucose 6-phosphate and then goes down the glycolytic pathway. That's useless for energy levels in the blood. All right. Now, any questions about this pathway, ladies and gentlemen? All righty then. Let's go on, shall we, to what? What are we doing here? There it is. No, let's go on to this one. Ding, 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 ding. All right, so glycogen. Glycogen metabolism and gluconeogenesis, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so you're going to find out what the structure of glycogen is. You're going to find out how it interrelates with some of the simple sugars. You're going to take a look at glycogenolysis, glycogen synthesis, the control of glycogen metabolism, which we've looked at already somewhat. You're going to overview a cyclic AMP second messenger system, allosteric control, muscle and liver tissue control, hormonal control, gluconeogenesis overview, and then control of gluconeogenesis and glycolysis. Very straightforward. That's what's in this section. Next, what's the structure of glycogen? Glycogen is highly branched. Glycogen, however, a typical molecule of glycogen has one blank end and many blank ends. One blank end and many blank ends. Oh, you guys, absolutely right. One reducing end and many non-reducing ends. And glycogen phosphorylase attacks from the non-reducing ends. So multiple glycogen phosphorylases can be acting on a single molecule of glycogen. You've seen a Kush ball. And you guys know what a Kush ball is? For those of you who do not, I need to show you because it is a powerful analogy, very, very similar to what goes on in glycogen. Kush ball images, click. Kush ball looks exactly like this. You can see where there's multiple ends. Oh, come on. Multiple ends. All sticking out. Well, if you can imagine, these ends, these rubber bands here, are actually themselves branched. And those are branched, and those are branched, and those are branched, and those are branched. Then you have an idea of what glycogen is like. Embedded throughout this is intense amounts of water to keep it solubilized. Right? So whenever you have a quick weight loss or someone who's not been losing weight at all, if they're tremendously overweight, you can get them to lose 5 or 10 pounds almost within a week if they start exercising and start using up their glycogen stores that they have in their liver and muscle tissue, because all those glycogen stores are just saturated with water, and much of the weight loss you have when you initially begin to lose weight is the glycogen being lost. And then after the first 5 or 10 pounds, then that's when the heavy lifting comes, because you're losing fat molecules and they're much less hydrated. Okay, so you can see here many non-reducing ends, branch poise, reducing ends. So lots and lots of 1,6 branches, of course, lots of 1,4 branches. Highly branched three-dimensional molecule has a protein in the middle called glycogen. So write in glycogen. Glycogenin. There's one glycogenin and protein per molecule of glycogen. One reducing end, many non-reducing, highly hydrated. Lysis occurs simultaneously at many ends. Rapid release of not glucose 6-phosphate, but glucose 1-phosphate. I can't tell you how many times students lose points when they think the product of glycogen phosphorylase is glucose 6-phosphate. The product of glycogen phosphorylase is glucose 1-phosphate that has to be mutated into glucose 6-phosphate. All right. Now, so that's the structure of glycogen. Now, in general, how do we get starch and glycogen even into the system? If you're eating meat and you get glycogen, or you're a plant-based, if you're a herbivore, how do you get it in there? Well, you've seen me draw this before. On this blank on overhead number 4, the first blank is amylase, the second blank is saccharidases. Right. So the digestion of starch and glycogen occurs early. Alpha amylase, both salivary and pancreatic. Amylase produces maltose, maltotriose, and alpha limit dextrins. What in the world, Dr. Novak, is alpha limit dextrins? Well, as you can imagine, starch molecules have this kind of structure. And what can happen is that you end up, this protein has a particular size as it cleaves off these proteins. And as it approaches this branch point, 1-6 branch point, it gets to a point where you can't get into that branch point. And so you end up making thousands of these Ys that are all the 1-6 branch points. This and this and this and this and this and this. Hundreds of these things. These are called alpha limit dextrins because the alpha amylase couldn't get to it. It's limited. So you have all these branch points. There are specific enzymes that are produced either by the pancreas or on the surface of the endothelial cells that can actually act on those. All right, so then you have the surface saccharidases, disaccharides, maltotrioses, alpha limit dextrins. Lactose, starch, and sucrose are the primary carbohydrates. Amylase acts on the starch to make maltose, maltotriose, alpha limit dextrins. That's the one thing I didn't include in the previous diagram. Lactase, alpha glucosidases, sucrases all make lactose, glucose, and fructose. All of them have pumps that get brought in. Into the interior of the epithelial cells, which are then pumped into the capillaries, glucose, galactose, and fructose. And then that's where all that's accumulated in the portal vein and sent through the liver and pancreas, dropped by the pancreas. That's how you get carbohydrate into your body. There are other carbohydrates that the body can handle pretty regularly. You can see them here. Amylopectin, amylose, sucrose, trehalose. These are in young mushrooms, interestingly enough. If you sometimes have trouble with young mushrooms, eating them, that may be why. Lactose, fructose, galactose. And this bottom one is raffinose. That's an interesting, it's a fairly complicated structure. Notice it's leguminous seeds. That means pinto beans and black beans. And if you get gas, flatulence, from having going to Taco Bell, it's primarily because of this sugar right here combined. If it smells, that means that you have both a bean that contained a lot of this raffinose, which bacteria can readily break down, but you break down slower. That's why you get that gas, because the bacteria break it down much, much more quickly than you can. If there's a little sulfur with that, with your beans, then you make this hydrogen sulfide, and that's where the smell comes from in part. Yes?
If somebody starts eating beans more regularly,
uh-huh,
can your body start producing?
Yes. The body is adaptable for producing that. If you eat beans regularly, many times, the efficiency and the numbers of enzymes for those particular breakdowns unique to those beans would increase. Yeah. The body is adaptable. People who have a mild lactose intolerance, if they don't eat any milk at all or cheese products, if they do that for a long time, lose all lactase. It's just you have to challenge it at times to keep it going if you have a mild case. So if you have a mild case of lactose intolerance, don't give up drinking milk and eating cheese and all that kind of stuff. Keep challenging it or you'll lose it entirely. Okay, you will not need to memorize any of this stuff. It's just an interesting thing to have to show that there are many more complex carbohydrates than you would suspect in your body. Let's go take a look at now this next thing. We have about 3 minutes. The first break, first blank is phosphorylase. Next blank is G1P. Notice glycogen phosphorylase does not produce glucose 6-phosphate. It produces glucose 1-phosphate. The next enzyme is debranching enzyme. And the next blank is two separate different activities of one protein, sort of like the one I talked about, F26P. Then you have phosphoglucomutase. That's the one that's designed to transform glucose 1-phosphate and glucose 6. The next blank is PLP, which is derived from vitamin B6. Next blank is AMP. Next blank is ATP. Under the next blank is debranching. And the next blank is maltotriose. And the last blank on overhead number 6 is phosphoglucomutase. Near equilibrium, reversible, but in a handy thing. All right, so glycogen, to break down glycogen completely, you have to have three enzymes, three activities. Three, count them, three to produce glucose 6-phosphate from glycogen. The first one and the most important one, of course, is glycogen phosphorylase. It's the most highly regulated, both by allosteric effectors and by covalent changes, kinases and phosphatases. Produces that glucose 1-phosphate, which is the immediate product of glycogen phosphorylase. Then you also have to have a debranching enzyme. The fascinating chemistry, I just love that. It's the cutest little enzyme. It does an amazing thing. Just does the most amazing thing. And we'll talk about that next. Contains two separate enzymes. We'll talk about what that means. And you have phosphoglucomutase, which is relatively boring because it is it's reversible and does only one thing. It's a one-trick pony. It's not regulated. Glycogen phosphorylase has two states, T, which is also labeled B, and R, which is labeled A. Typically, the R state and the A state, which is also sometimes labeled the A state, is the most active of the enzymes. So if you have an enzyme that has two states, and you have the A state or the R state, that's the one that's active. Okay, that's typically the one that's active. And it also contains that PLP cofactor, which I should show you the structure of it. That's, again, shows up on the final. And I've got to stop here, I guess. T is conformationally buried active site with low affinity for substrates. And we'll continue this discussion, my yelling at you at a high rate of volume, on Tuesday morning. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a delight. Please read chapter 15 and start chapter 16. Read.